This is the Science Set Free podcast. I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon. And today we're going to talk about dreams. Mark, the reason I thought about this was that over the Christmas period, there are all these readings that come up in the Bible. The wise men go to see King Herod. They go to visit the baby Jesus in Bethlehem. And then they're warned in a dream not to go back to see Herod, and they head off by another route. And all through the Bible, there are these stories of people having dreams, visionary dreams. When Jacob sees the ladder of angels ascending and descending between heaven and earth at Bethel, that's described as a dream. And many of the visionary parts of the Bible, things that are sometimes called revelation, in that rather off-putting word, you know, revealed truths, are actually revelations that occur through dreams.
Yeah.
And we all have dreams, and most dreams are rather a jumble, and sometimes we have dreams that seem more significant than others, and psychotherapists interpret dreams in all sorts of ways. So the question really is, how do we distinguish between dreams that are of this special significance that might even in biblical terms rank as revelations, things on which people act and which play a very large part in biblical history and in the history of other groups too? I mean, it's not just in the Bible. I mean, there's many instances of dreams having a very special significance. And how are these different from ordinary dreams? And how is it that dreams can be a channel for the spirit?
Yeah, I mean, I'd noticed that around Christmas as well. I'd sort of noticed that it's the dark time of year, and it seems appropriate somehow that suddenly there's all these stories with dreams and coming up. It's as if it's a slightly more dreamy time of day, of the year, compared to the brightness of the summer. The Bible is pretty interesting on dreams, because although there are these stories, such as you've mentioned, there's also quite a lot of concern about dreams. And so some of the Hebrew prophets, like, for example, Jeremiah, will say, you know, don't listen to all those who are having dreams. This is the word of the Lord. And the early church fathers, too, some were very concerned about dreams and people pursuing dreams or interpreting dreams, perhaps over-interpreting them. Maybe with the new dispensation, the release of the Spirit in the early church, you know, something needed to be understood, you might say, rather than just let go willy-nilly. So what I take this ambivalence to be about really is that there is a real task when it comes to discerning dreams. You don't just have a dream neat, as if God's spoken to you directly. It always comes jumbled with your own stuff. Which is what you'd expect the minute you think about it, because it's in your mind, it's going to be spoken in a language which is partly your language. Otherwise, you just wouldn't understand it at all. But that's got to mean you've got to tease out what's overlaid with your own images, your own concerns, preoccupations, fears, hopes, to try and distill something more profound. And that is, in fact, what psychotherapy tries to do, really. Basically, is it tries to provide tools or ways of talking about dreams, just in a way training yourself to think about dreams, take them seriously even to start with, that can begin a process of trying to see through the immediacy of them to understand what they might be saying. So discernment, I think, is the key thing, which you get going all the way back to the Bible as well as in modern psychotherapy.
Yes, I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it, that, you know, one of the first examples we have of dream interpretation is Joseph in Egypt interpreting the Pharaoh's dreams.
And he being deeply sought after because he could do it.
You know, exactly.
There is a kind of skill to it or
exactly.
Something like that.
He was obviously highly respected. The Pharaoh had a whole retinue of soothsayers and wise men and stuff, but Joseph was better at it.
Yeah.
And I think it's not a coincidence that one of the people who made dream interpretation so mainstream in the 20th century, Sigmund Freud, was Jewish. And Freud's house, when you go to the Freud Museum here in Hampstead, is full of Egyptian figurines. You know, he had a whole collection of kind of Egyptian statues and stuff in his study. So I think Freud was felt very connected to Egypt, and Jews in Egypt were sort of laid the foundations of dream interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, Freud's famous remark is that dreams were the royal road to the unconscious, to that side of ourselves that we otherwise don't have very good access to. And I'm sure that he surrounded himself, as you say, with these figurines and gods and images in order to try and bring closer together the dream life with waking life.
Yes.
To sort of blur the boundaries a bit in order to access them more fully and try and understand and engage them more fully.
He thought of the unconscious as being somehow below the level of consciousness. Jung, of course, thought that it also included a collective memory through the collective unconscious. And so we've got the possibility that dreams include both personal memories and collective memories, desires, unfulfilled wishes, and all that kind of thing, which is fairly standard in psychotherapeutic theory. But they also, through the researches of psychic research, are often a channel through which telepathic communications come. People often have dreams that, for example, of someone they know might appear to them in a dream in a particularly vivid way, and it often turns out that person's died at that particular moment somewhere else without them knowing about it. The early studies of the Society for Psychical Research on dream telepathy often involved visitations from the dead. People didn't know they were dying, but they occur in waking life too, but dreams are a particularly open channel for this kind of communication.
Yeah, and I think that that's where some of the modern discernment can really come in, because certainly in psychotherapy, in the first instance, you tend to take people's dreams of others as reflections of themselves. So in the first instance, the idea is that you might well dream of somebody in your family, someone you've met, an incident that previous day, because you have, as it were, projected something of yourself onto that individual. They then appear in your dream as if the dream is speaking back to you that part of yourself that you're not quite aware of having. You know, so for example, you might dream of the angry man in the car park, and maybe that's actually saying there's an angry side to yourself that the dream is trying to make known. This would be quite a Jungian interpretation, the idea that dreams try and correct things that have gone off balance in the psyche. Mm. And they come up in the dream because when we're asleep, when we're dreaming, our defences are that much lowered. And so the psyche can sort of speak to us in ways that with our waking, willful conscious, we're not so prepared to tolerate. Hmm. So that's one way of thinking about that. But I certainly, I know the research as well, and that sometimes these very vivid dreams, the sort of super dreams or lucid dreams, when it does really feel as if there's something other than just your own psyche that's active, that's taking part. Mm. And then dreams which feature somebody else, I think, can then have this more telepathic quality, as it were, that the collective field, to use the Jungian term, is coming through in a very direct and specific way. Mm. I think there's a real art to getting to know your dreams and getting to know quite what's been said and knowing yourself too, so that you get to know what might be actually your own stuff more, and then you get to become clear about what is speaking beyond you as well. You just have that sense, you know, this isn't quite my stuff, even the difficult stuff. Maybe this is saying something else.
Well, there's a whole other category of things that come in dreams, which is flashes of the future, precognitive dreams. Many people have those, and you probably know J.W. Dunn's book, An Experiment with Time, you know, where he discovers that he's having these precognitive dreams of things that happen in the next 2 or 3 days, usually. And when I read it, I thought, well, this seems very implausible, because he argues everyone has this, but they just don't know it because they forget their dreams. So he says, try it for yourself, write your dreams down. And when I did that, which I did for a week or two, I learned how to remember the dreams by writing them down straight away when I woke up. Within a week, I'd had several striking examples of dreaming of things that happened that I couldn't possibly have known about within the next day or two. So I was convinced he was right. And the literature of psychical research has many examples of these, and I made a collection myself of people's dreams before the World Trade Center disaster, the 9/11 disaster, of a collection of more than 70 dreams from people in New York, which foreshadowed in all sorts of ways the planes crashing into buildings, skyscrapers collapsing, clouds of dust rolling down streets, and so on. Foreshadowed things that would happen. So that's another component of dreams, that that we seem to be open not only to other people in our dreams, not only to, of course, to our own unconscious and memories and to other people's memories, but also to the future.
It's a very interesting area, because although I'm very interested in my own dreams and have a practice of recording them and so on, I don't actually think I have many precognitive dreams. I mean, in the moment now, I couldn't actually tell you one. I couldn't remember one. And I just wonder whether part of what that's about is that what you ask for, as it were, from your dreams affects what your dreams show you. Mm. Maybe that would only to be expected as well, because during the course of a night, presumably you have dozens and dozens of dreams, mm. But you maybe only remember one, two, or three. Mm. And so there's a part of your mind which, if you sort of prime it to remember dreams of a certain sort, will then, elucidate those particular dreams. You know, so I treat my dreams mostly as part of my own self-exploration and my work as a psychotherapist. Mm. And so sure enough, the dreams which I remember seem to speak to me more of particularly tricky emotional situations. I find that my dreams, most commonly, they give me a kind of a visual image of a situation which I'm finding tricky to handle. Mm. And if I can stay with the image, then it helps me kind of process the emotion and befriend it a bit more, build up a relationship with it a bit more. Mm. But you're making me think that maybe I should sort of adjust what I ask of my dreams and see whether things change.
Well, Dunn makes the point, as you may remember, that this works best when you're travelling or when you're doing unusual things, because when you're just staying at home and leading a normal life, it's hard to distinguish between images from the past and the future. For example, if you dreamt of it being in the kitchen in your house and making breakfast or something, you wouldn't really know whether that was yesterday or tomorrow sort of thing. When you're travelling or in exotic circumstances, then there are striking things happening. So it's more likely to be noticeable then. And the other thing he says is that you should not write down an interpretation of the dream, but just the imagery that you have, because the imagery, it's the images rather than the way you interpret the images that's usually the clue.
This is another aspect that you think a lot about in psychotherapy, is when to try and make an interpretation and when just to try and stay in the dream image and let that be the primary language, because anyone who remembers dreams will have the experience of writing it down afterwards and realizing that in the act of doing that, something is lost.
Yes.
And that the dream was much more vivid, much more detailed than what you remember, let alone write down. And in fact, Jung, his favourite method of working with dreams was what he called amplification, which was in a way a much more artistic way of engaging with dreams, where you would go into the creativity of the dream again and try and expand on that creativity, let it run with you, whether that be by painting, by playing with things, by writing. But amplification, to stay in the dream zone more, and in a way let that itself do the work as much as possible, rather than trying to give the sovereign conscious mind, its way, which can... I think there's a sort of sense you need to integrate things, but not to cut off things as well.
Mm.
So it's quite an art as well as a practice, learning to discern dreams.
Well, there's also the practice of lucid dreaming. I've only had a few, and I had them when I was a child, much more. But there are some people who cultivate this practice, which is, as it were, waking up within the dream, knowing that you're dreaming within the dream. And then people have a greater sense of control and able to direct what happens in the dream. Now, the Tibetans have a practice where they actually encourage lucid dreaming, because they think that this ability to be in control of the dream helps you in preparing for dying. As we discussed in our dialogue on what happens when we die, one way of thinking of the after-death state is like a dream that from which you can no longer wake up. And if you've practiced lucid dreaming during your lifetime, then you're in a better state to deal with this after-death condition than if you haven't. Mm. I mean, that's the Tibetan view.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the phenomenon of lucid dreaming is well attested in all sorts of situations as well. And again, speaks to a Jungian point, which is that we are actually dreaming all the time. It's just that in conscious life, as it were, the bright lights of the day throw the dreams into the shadows. So it the idea of lucid dreaming, where there can be some sort of consciousness while you're unconscious, is to say that these states only seem completely separate, but it's possible to develop. I think it takes time, and I think it does take quite a time to do this, and certainly to do it in any sustained way. But it can be a way into understanding how consciousness is actually really very pluriform and has many different sort of dimensions that can be nonetheless accessed, you know, in a fairly daily kind of way. I wanted perhaps just to say something as well on the back of that about people that don't have dreams, because I'm aware that people might be listening and thinking, well, I just never have a dream. I've certainly had this when I've done workshops. And a couple of things sometimes are helpful. One is to make an intention to remember dreams. And you can do this quite simply by putting a piece of paper and a pen by the side of your bed. And it's quite surprising how many people then do have dreams in the next few days. But also, I quite like the idea that dreams aren't just what happen when we're asleep. You know, we have words like daydreaming and going into a slight different sort of reveries during the course of the day. And in fact, I often think that a part of what a good liturgy or a good ritual enables you to do is to go into a sort of more dreamlike state, so that the physical immediate activity comes to carry all sorts of symbolic meanings, and that your mind can free associate around them. And I think everything from going to a communion service to chanting, all these different kind of activities, in a way they bring to the surface this dream state as well.
Well, I suppose one could argue that, say, plays, dramas, films, TV shows, fictional things are a kind of exploration of a kind of collective dream world. I mean, these are not things that are real. And in our own experience, if we just take our own experience, we've got our own waking experience, we've got our own dreams. And then in all cultures, myths, stories, tales, and now with films and TV, these are dramatised in a much more vivid way.
Yeah, I mean, I've done work with, just once or twice, but done some work with brands, well-known brands, that use soap operas, that use TV programs, and study them for their mood, for their affect, for the kind of archetypal characters that appear in them. And they do that because they take it as evidence of what is going on in the collective dream of the culture at the time, in order to try and understand it, and then to know how their brand does or doesn't resonate with it. But this is, you know, taken really very seriously in commerce. So why wouldn't we take it seriously in other aspects of life?
The thing, just come back to where we started about these biblical dreams, is that they also imply that, people not just get images from themselves and from other people in the collective unconscious or from the future, but directly from God or the Holy Spirit or the angels, that dreams can be inspired and from a level beyond the human level of consciousness, that they're a channel of inspiration. I mean, that seems to me perfectly plausible, because any view of inspiration, you know, when we just say that composers are inspired or artists are inspired or scientists are inspired, the very concept of inspiration is the idea that there's a source from a higher level of consciousness that's working through us. And it would be very surprising if that only happens in the waking state and not in dreams. In fact, it may happen more in dreams. So the in many cultures and religions and traditions, there's the idea of inspired dreams, That seems to me something the Bible's very strong on, because there's so many examples of them.
Yeah, sometimes people call them big dreams. Mm. They may be less frequent. In fact, they may even feel they've only had a handful or one or two in a whole life, but they somehow stay with you. And you can spend many years trying to know how to relate to that dream, to know what sense to make of it. I have heard people talk about these and how it can be a really very lonesome experience to have had this big dream and not to know quite what to do with it, because it seems so outlandish. Mm. And not know quite who to turn to, and people might think you're mad, or if you say, I dreamt I talked to God, some people might put a label of psychotic or something like that onto it.
Yes.
But I think that, so it's to say there's something about, there's a fearfulness to dreams, I suppose you could say.
Mm.
And actually in the biblical stories it's often in the dream an angel will appear saying, fear not.
Yes.
As if this can be quite a challenge, it can feel quite overwhelming. But nonetheless, I think that's right, that these inspiring dreams can be worked through and taken into life in order that your own sense of life is greatly expanded as a result. Someone once said to me that dreams are always a gift from the unconscious. And I think what they meant by that is that they're a part of yourself or a part of the collective or even God, trying to offer you something which, although it can feel quite disturbing or unsettling or just bemusing to start with, it's like a gift that over time you learn to unwrap and to enter into and to take into your own life.
Mm. I think this relates to a topic that we've discussed before, and I've forgotten if it was one of our recorded or unrecorded discussions, namely dream incubation. That in the ancient Greek world, the people went to shrines, healing shrines like Epidaurus, and slept in the shrine with the hope of a healing dream from the god. Now, this was then Christianized in the Greek Orthodox Church, and for centuries people have slept in churches of Saints Cosmo and Damian, the twin healing saints, to incubate healing dreams. And when I was in India, living in Hyderabad, some Muslim friends took me to a Sufi shrine near Hyderabad where people slept in the courtyards of the shrine for healing dreams. And they'd go, someone who was disturbed in some way would go with their family, who'd be with them. They'd all sleep in this courtyard round the Durga, the shrine of the saint, where the saint was buried. And many of them had the saint appear to them in dreams with healing messages. And the reason so many people went there was because it worked. A lot of people got better as a result of these healing dreams. So this is a tradition that crosses different cultures, pre-Christian, Christian, Muslim, and probably in many other cultures too. I should imagine in shamanic cultures this is a common practice as well. But what I look forward to is the reinstatement of healing dreams within our own tradition. And I think if some of our churches or cathedrals opened up to this and people could go there and sleep there hoping and praying for a healing dream with an appropriate liturgy beforehand, like Compline or something, this lovely evening service, late night service, and then with someone leading this, like you, and offering help in interpretation in the morning if anyone has these healing dreams, I think it would be a wonderful thing to do. It would cost practically nothing and would provide a whole new use for the great sacred spaces that we have.
Yeah, well, I mean, psychotherapy, people vary how they use psychotherapy, but many people will use psychotherapy to explore their dreams in pursuit of healing. So it completely makes sense. The incubation is well attested to actually in the Western tradition through philosophy, in fact. So Parmenides, one of the pre-Socratic philosophers, he was well known in the Temple of Asclepius to be a sort of shaman figure who could interpret these dreams. And in fact, his bit of philosophy that survives is a dream written out as a poem that launched a project which we now call metaphysics. He's known as the father of metaphysics. Mm. And in particular, his dream showed him that what we take to be usual appearance isn't the true reality at all. This launched for him his project of metaphysics. And so originally, reason was actually a form of trying to interpret dreams. And he argued that using reason, we can peer through the surface appearance to understand and get a glimpse of a deeper reality. Mm. And this is now a very, very common assumption in science, that appearances deceive and we need to see something of a pattern that's deeper. And I think at origin, at least, and maybe in terms of the inspiration that scientists get too, the idea that there's something deeper that you're trying to discern beneath the dazzlement of appearances is something that links both science, reason, and in fact dreams, and shamanism as well. So I think in origin there's actually many profound links here.
I think that's a very good point to conclude our discussion. I mean, it's fascinating. There's a great deal more to find out, and a great deal more that can actually be done in terms of encouraging healing dreams and inspirational dreams.
And people can begin it sort of right now, certainly tonight, remember, yes, a dream and see what happens.
Free of charge.